Chapter 2 The Hand of God 137 Outside the palace, in the sharp cold of a winter's afternoon, the clear sky was full of what looked like glittering snow. Horsa paused on the war shuttle's ramp and looked up and around. The sheer walls and slim towers of the prison palace echoed and reflected with the booms and flashes of continuing firefights, while Idiran gun platforms cruised back and forth, firing occasionally. Around them, on the stiffening breeze, blew great clouds of chaff from anti-laser mortars on the palace roof. A gust sent some of the fluttering, flickering foil toward the stationary shuttle, and Horsa found one side of his wet and sticky body suddenly coated with reflecting plumage.
"Please, the battle is not over yet," thundered the Idiran soldier behind him,
in what was probably meant to be a quiet whisper. Horsa turned round to the armoured bulk, and stared up at the visor of the giant's helmet, where he could see his own old man's face reflected. He breathed deeply, then nodded, turned and walked slightly shakily into the shuttle. A flash of light threw his shadow diagonally in front of him, and the craft bucked in the shockwave of a big explosion somewhere inside the palace as the ramp closed. "By their names you could know them," Horsa thought as he showered. The culture's general contact units, which until now had borne the brunt of the first 4 years of the war in space, had always chosen jokey, facetious names. Even the new warships they were starting to produce, as their factory craft completed gearing up their war production, favoured either jocular, sombre, or downright unpleasant names, as though the culture could not take entirely seriously the vast conflict in which it had embroiled itself. The Idirans looked at things differently. To them, a ship name ought to reflect the serious nature of its purpose, duties and resolute use. In the huge Idiran navy, there were hundreds of craft named after the same heroes, planets, battles, religious concepts and impressive adjectives. The light cruiser which had rescued Horsa was the 137th vessel to be called the Hand of God, and it existed concurrently with over 100 other craft in the navy using the same title, so its full name was the Hand of God 137. Horsa dried in the airstream with some difficulty. Like everything else in the spaceship, it was built on a monumental scale befitting the size of the Idirans, and the hurricane of air it produced nearly blew him out of the shower cabinet. The Quirrell Zuralundra, spyfather and warrior priest of the Four Souls tributary sect of Far Nidir, clasped two hands on the surface of the table. It looked to Horsa rather like a pair of continental plates colliding.
"So, Bor-Horsa," boomed the old Idiran, "you are recovered."
"Just about," nodded Horsa, rubbing his wrists. He sat in Zoralundra's cabin, in the Hand of God 137, clothed in a bulky but comfortable spacesuit, apparently brought along just for him. Zoralundra, who was also seated up, had insisted the man wear it because the warship was still at battle stations as it swept a fast and low-powered orbit around the planet of Sorpan. A culture GCU of the Mountain class had been confirmed in the system by naval intelligence. The Hand was on its own, and they couldn't find any trace of the culture ship, so they had to be careful. Zoralundra leaned toward Horsa, casting a shadow over the table. His huge head, saddle-shaped when seen from directly in front, with the two front eyes, clear and unblinking near the edges, loomed over the changer.
"You are lucky, Horsa. We did not come in to rescue you out of compassion. Failure is its own reward."
"Thank you, Zora. That's actually the nicest thing anybody said to me all day." Horsa sat back in his seat and put one of his old-looking hands through his thin, yellowing hair. It would take a few days for the aged appearance he had assumed to disappear, though already he could feel it starting to slip away from him. In a changer's mind, there was a self-image constantly held and reviewed on a semi-subconscious level, keeping the body and the appearance willed. Horsa's need to look like a gerontocrat was gone now, so the mental picture of the minister he had impersonated for the Idirans was fragmenting and dissolving, and his body was going back to its normal, neutral state. Zoralundra's head went slowly from side to side between the edges of the suit collar. It was a gesture Horsa had never fully translated, although he had worked for the Idirans and known Zoralundra well since before the war.
"Anyway, you are alive," Zoralundra said.
Horsa nodded and drummed his fingers on the table to show he agreed. He wished the Idiran chair he had perched on didn't make him feel so much like a child. His feet weren't even touching the deck. "Just? Thanks, anyway. I'm sorry I dragged you all the way in here just to rescue a failure."
"Orders are orders," I personally am glad we were able to. Now I must tell you why we received those orders.
Horza smiled and looked away from the old Diran, who had just given him something of a compliment, a rare thing. He looked back and watched the other being's wide mouth. Big enough, thought Horza, to bite off both your hands at once, as it boomed out the precise, short words of the Adiran language.
You were once with a caretaker mission of Shar's world, one of the Draizon planets of the dead, Zorlandra stated.
Horza nodded.
We need you to go back there.
Now, Horza said to the broad, dark face of the Adiran. There are only changes there. I've told you I won't impersonate another changer. I certainly won't kill one.
We are not asking you to do that. Listen while I explain.
Zorlandra leaned on his backrest, in a way almost any vertebrate, or even anything like a vertebrate, would have called tired.
4 standard days ago, the Adiran began.
Then his suit helmet, which was lying on the floor near his feet, let out a piercing whine. He picked up the helmet and set it on the table.
Yes,
he said. And Horza knew enough about the Adiran voice to realize that whoever was bothering the Quirl had better have a good reason for doing so.
We have the culture female, a voice said from the helmet.
Ah, Zorlandra said quietly, sitting back.
The Adiran equivalent of a smile, mouth pursing, eyes narrowing, passed over his features.
Good, Captain. Is she aboard yet?
No, Quirl. The shuttle is a couple of minutes out. I'm withdrawing the gun platforms. We are ready to leave the system as soon as they are all on board.
Zorlandra bent closer to the helmet. Horza inspected the aged skin on the back of his hands.
What of the culture ship? The Adiran asked.
Still nothing, Quirl. It cannot be anywhere in the system. Our computer suggests it is outside, possibly between us and the fleet. Before long it must realize we are in here by ourselves.
You will set off to rejoin the fleet the instant the female culture agent is aboard, without waiting for the platforms. Is that understood, Captain?
Zorlandra looked at Horza as the human glanced at him.
Is that understood, Captain?
The Quirl repeated, still looking at the human.
Yes, Quirl, came the answer.
Horza could hear the icy tone, even through the small helmet speaker.
Good. Use your own initiative to decide the best route back to the fleet. In the meantime, you will destroy the cities of De'Echanbi, Vinch, Eaz Nayawan, Isilir, and Ilbar with fusion bombs as per the Admiralty's orders.
Yes, Quirl.
Zorlandra stabbed a switch in the helmet, and it fell silent.
You got Balveda?
Horza asked, surprised.
We have the culture agent, yes. I regard her capture or destruction as of comparatively little consequence. But only by our assuring the Admiralty we would attempt to take her would they contemplate such a hazardous mission ahead of the main fleet to rescue you.
Bet you didn't get Balveda's knife missile,
Horza snorted, looking again at the wrinkles on his hands.
It distracted while you were being put aboard the shuttle which brought you up to the ship.
Zorlandra waved one hand, sending a draft of Adiran-scented air across the table.
But enough of that. I must explain why we risked a light cruiser to rescue you.
By all means, Horza said, and turned to face the Adiran.
4 standard days ago, the Quirl said. A group of our ships intercepted a single culture craft of conventional outward appearance, but rather odd internal construction, judging by its emission signature. The ship was destroyed easily enough, but its mind escaped. There was a planetary system nearby. The mind appears to have transcended real space to within the planetary surface of the globe it chose, thus indicating a level of hyperspatial field management we had thought, hoped, was still beyond the culture. Certainly such spatiobatics are beyond us for the moment. We have reason to believe, due to that and other indications, that the mind involved is one from a new class of general systems vehicles the culture is developing. The mind's capture would be an intelligence coup of the first order.
The Quirl paused there. Horza took the opportunity to ask,
Is this thing on Shah's world?
Yes, according to his last message, it intended to shelter in the tunnels of the command system.
And you can't do anything about it? Horza smiled.
We came to get you. That is doing something about it, Bora Horza.
The Quirl paused.
The shape of your mouth tells me you see something amusing in this situation. What would that be?
I was just thinking. Lots of things. That the mind was either pretty smart or very lucky. That you were very lucky you had me close by. Also that the culture isn't likely to sit back and do nothing.
To deal with your points in order, Zorlandra said sharply. The culture mind was both lucky and smart. We were fortunate. The culture can do little because they do not, as far as we know, have any changes in their employ, and certainly not one who has served on Char's world. I would also add, Borohosa, the adherent said, putting both huge hands on the table and dipping his great head toward the human, that you were more than a little lucky yourself.
Ah, yes. But the difference is that I believe in it. Horza grinned.
It does you little credit, observed the Quirrell.
Horza shrugged. So you want me to put down on Char's world and get the mind?
If possible. It may be damaged. It may be liable to destruct, but it is a prize worth fighting for. We shall give you all the equipment you need, but your presence alone would give us a toehold.
What about the people already there? The changes on caretaker duty?
Nothing has been heard from them. They were probably unaware of the mine's arrival. Their next routine transmission is due in a few days, but given the current disruption in communications due to the war, they may not be able to send.
What? Horza said slowly, one finger describing a circular pattern on the table surface which he was looking at. Do you know about the personnel in the base?
The two senior members have been replaced by younger changers, the adherent said. The two junior sentinels became seniors, remaining there.
They wouldn't be in any danger, would they? Horza asked.
On the contrary. Inside the Draesan quiet barrier on the planet of the dead must rank as one of the safest places to be during the current hostilities. Neither we nor the culture can risk causing the Draesan any offence. That is why they cannot do anything, and we can only use you.
If, Horza said carefully, sitting forward and dropping his voice slightly, I can get this metaphysical computer for you.
Something in your voice tells me we approach the question of remuneration, Zoralandra said.
We do indeed. I've risked my neck for you lot long enough, Zoralandra. I want out. There's a good friend of mine on that Shah's world base, and if she's agreeable, I want to take her and me out of the whole war. That's what I'm asking for.
I can promise nothing. I shall request this. Your long and devoted service will be taken into account.
Horza sat back and frowned. He wasn't sure if Zoralandra was being ironic or not. 6 years probably didn't seem like very long at all to a species that was virtually immortal. But the Quirrell Zoralandra knew how often his frail human charge had risked all in the service of his alien masters without real reward. So perhaps he was being serious. Before Horza could continue with the bargaining, the helmet shrilled once more. Horza winced. All the noises on the adherent ship seemed to be deafening. The voices were thunder. Ordinary buzzers and bleepers left his ears ringing long after they stopped, and announcements over the PA made him put both hands to his head. Horza just hoped there wasn't a full-scale alarm while he was on board. The adherent ship alarm could cause damage to unprotected human ears.
What is it? Zoralandra asked the helmet.
The female is on board. I shall need only 8 more minutes to get the gun.
Have the cities been destroyed?
They have, Quirrell.
Break out of orbit at once and make full speed for the fleet.
Quirrell, I must point out, said the small, steady voice from the helmet on the table.
Captain, Zoralandra said briskly. In this war, there have to date been 14 single dual engagements between Type 5 light cruisers and mountain-class general contact units. All have ended in victory for the enemy. Have you ever seen what is left of a light cruiser after a GCU has finished with it?
No, Quirrell.
Neither have I. And I have no intention of seeing it for the first time from the inside. Proceed at once.
Zoralandra hit the helmet button again. He fastened his gaze on Horza.
I shall do what I can to secure your release from the service with sufficient funds if you succeed. Now, once we have made contact with the main body of the fleet, you will go by fast picket to Char's world. You will be given a shuttle there, just beyond the quiet barrier. It will be unarmed, although it will have the equipment we think you may need, including some close-range hyperspace spectrographic analyzers should the mind conduct a limited destruct.
How can you be certain it'll be limited? Horza asked skeptically.
The mind weighs several thousand tons, despite its relatively small size. An annihilatory destruct would rip the planet in half and so antagonize the Draesan. No culture mind would risk such a thing.
Your confidence overwhelms me, Horza said dourly. Just then, the note of background noise around them altered.
Zoralandra turned his helmet round and looked at one of its small internal screens.
Good, we are underway.
He looked at Horza again.
There is something else I ought to tell you. An attempt was made by the group of ships which caught the culture craft to follow the escaped mind down to the planet.
Horza frowned. Didn't they know better?
They did their best.
With the battle group were several captured Choihirtzi warp animals, which had been deactivated for later use in a surprise attack on a culture base. One of these was quickly fitted out for a small-scale incursion on the planet's surface and thrown at the quiet barrier in a warp cruise.
The ruse did not succeed. On crossing the barrier, the animal was attacked with something resembling grid fire and was heavily damaged. It came out of warp near the planet on a course which would take it in on a burn-up angle. The equipment and ground force it contained must be considered defunct.
Well, I suppose it was a good try. But a Drow Azen must make even this wonderful mind you're after look like a valve computer. It's going to take more than that to fool it.
Do you think you'll be able to?
I don't know. I don't think they can read minds, but who knows? I don't think the Drow Azen even know or care much about the war or what I've been doing since I left Shah's world. So they probably won't be able to put one and one together. But again, who knows?
Horza gave another shrug.
It's worth a try.
Good. We shall have a fuller briefing when we rejoin the fleet. For now we must pray that our return is without incident. You may want to speak to Perostek Belveda before she is interrogated. I have arranged with the Deputy Fleet Inquisitor that you may see her if you wish.
Horza smiled.
Zora, nothing would give me greater pleasure.
The Quirl had other business on the ship as it powered its way out of the Sorpan system. Horza stayed in Zoralandra's cabin to rest and eat before he called on Belveda. The food was the cruiser Autogalley's best impression of something suitable for a humanoid, but it tasted awful. Horza ate what he could and drank some equally uninspiring distilled water. It was all served by a Medjel, a lizard-like creature about 2 meters long with a flat, long head and 6 legs, on 4 of which it ran, using the front pair as hands. The Medjel were the companion species of the Adirans. It was a complicated sort of social symbiosis which had kept the exosocio faculties of many a university and research funds over the millennia that the Adiran civilization had been part of the galactic community. The Adirans themselves had evolved on their planet Idir as the top monster from a whole planetful of monsters. The frenetic and savage ecology of Idir in its early days had long since disappeared, and so had all the other homeworld monsters, except those in zoos. But the Idirans had retained the intelligence that made them winners, as well as the biological immortality which, due to the viciousness of the fight for survival back then, not to mention Idir's high radiation levels, had been an evolutionary advantage rather than a recipe for stagnation. Horza thanked the Medjel as it brought him plates and took them away again, but it said nothing. They were generally reckoned to be about 2/3 as intelligent as the average humanoid, whatever that was, which made them about 2 or 3 times dimmer than a normal Idiran. Still, they were good, if unimaginative, soldiers, and there were plenty of them, something like 10 or 12 for each Idiran. 40,000 years of breeding had made them loyal right down to the chromosome level. Horza didn't try to sleep, though he was tired. He told the Medjel to take him to Belveda. The Medjel thought about it, asked permission via the cabin intercom, and flinched visibly under a verbal slap from a distant Zoralandra, who was on the bridge with the cruiser captain.
"Follow me, sir," the Medjel said, opening the cabin door.
In the companionways of the warship, the Idiran atmosphere became more obvious than had been in Zoralandra's cabin. The smell of Idiran was stronger, and the view ahead hazed over, even seen through Horse's eyes after a few tens of meters. It was hot and humid, and the floor was soft. Horza walked quickly along the corridor, watching the stump of the Medjel's docked tail as it waggled in front of him. He passed 2 Adirans on the way, neither of whom paid him any attention. Perhaps they knew all about him and what he was, but perhaps not. Horza knew that Adirans hated to appear either over-inquisitive or under-informed. He nearly collided with a pair of wounded Medjel on AG stretchers being carried along a cross corridor by 2 of their fellow troopers. Horza watched as the wounded passed and frowned. The spiralled spatter marks on their battle armour was unmistakably those produced by a plasma bolt, and the gerontocracy didn't have any plasma weapons. He shrugged and walked on. They came to a section of the cruiser where the companionway was blocked by sliding doors. The Medjel spoke to each of the barriers in turn, and they opened. An Adiran guard holding a laser carbine stood outside a door. He saw the Medjel and Horza approaching and had the door open for the man by the time he got there. Horza nodded to the guard as he stepped through. The door hissed shut behind him, and another one immediately in front opened. Balveda turned quickly to him when he entered the cell. It looked as though she had been pacing up and down. She threw back her head a little when she saw Horza and made a noise in her throat which might have been a laugh.
"Well, well," she said, her soft voice drawling. "You survived. Congratulations. I did keep my promise, by the way. What a turnaround, eh?"
"Hello," Horza replied, folding his arms across the chest of his suit and looking the woman up and down. She wore the same grey gown and appeared to be unharmed. "What happened to that thing around your neck?" Horza asked. She looked down at where the pendant had lain over her breast.
"Well, believe it or not, it turned out to be a memory form."
She smiled at him and sat down cross-legged on the soft floor. Apart from a raised bed alcove, this was the only place to sit. Horza sat too, his legs hurting only a little. He recalled the spatter marks on the Medjel's armour. "A memory form? Wouldn't have turned into a plasma gun by any chance, would it?"
"Among other things," the culture agent nodded.
"Thought so. Heard your knife missile took the expansive way out." Balveda shrugged. Horza looked her in the eye and said, "I don't suppose you'd be here if you had anything important you could tell them, would you?"
"Here, perhaps," Balveda conceded. "Alive? No."
She stretched her arms out behind her and sighed. "I suppose I'll have to sit out the war in an internment camp, unless they can find somebody to swap. I just hope this thing doesn't go on too long."
"Ah, you think the culture might give in soon?" Horza grinned.
"No, I think the culture might win soon."
"You must be mad."
Horza shook his head.
"Well," Balveda said, nodding ruefully, "actually, I think it'll win eventually."
"If you keep falling back like you have for the last 3 years, you'll end up somewhere in the clouds."
"I'm not giving away any secrets, Horza, but I think you might find we don't do too much more falling back."
"We'll see. Frankly, I'm surprised you kept fighting this long."
"So are our three-legged friends. So is everybody. So are we, I sometimes think."
"Balveda," Horza sighed wearily, "I still don't know why the hell you're fighting in the first place. The Adirans were never any threat to you. They still wouldn't be if you stopped fighting them. Did life in your great utopia really get so boring you needed a war?"
"Horza," Balveda said, leaning forward, "I don't understand why you are fighting. I know Haydora is in Haybor,"
Horza interjected.
"Okay, the goddamn asteroid the changers live in. I know it's in Adiran space, but
that's got nothing to do with it, Balveda. I'm fighting for them because I think they're right and you're wrong."
Balveda sat back, amazed. "You..." she began, then lowered her head and shook it, staring at the floor. She looked up.
"I really don't understand you, Horza. You must know how many species, how many civilizations, how many systems, how many individuals have been either destroyed or throttled by the Adirans and their crazy goddamn religion. What the hell has the culture ever done compared to that?"
One hand was on her knee. The other was displayed in front of Horza, clawed into a strangling grip. He watched her and smiled.
"On a straight head count, the Adirans no doubt do come out in front, Perostek. And I've told them I never did care for some of their methods or their zeal. I'm all for people being allowed to live their own lives, but now they're up against you lot, and that's what makes the difference to me. Because I'm against you rather than for them. I'm prepared..."
Horza broke off for a moment, laughing lightly, self-consciously.
"Well, it sounds a bit melodramatic, but sure, I'm prepared to die for them."
He shrugged.
"Simple as that."
Horza nodded as he said it, and Balveda dropped the outstretched hand and looked away to one side, shaking her head and exhaling loudly. Horza went on.
"Because Well, I suppose you thought I was just kidding when I was telling old Frolk I thought the knife missile was the real representative. I wasn't kidding, Balvena. I meant it then, and I mean it now. I don't care how self-righteous the culture feels or how many people the Idirans kill. They're on the side of life. Boring, old-fashioned, biological life. Smelly, fallible and short-sighted, God knows, but real life. You're ruled by your machines. You're an evolutionary dead end. The trouble is that to take your minds off it, you try to drag everybody else down there with you. The worst thing that could happen to the galaxy would be if the culture wins this war. He paused to let her say something, but she was still sitting with her head down, shaking it. He laughed at her. You know, Balvena, for such a sensitive species, you show remarkably little empathy at times. Empathize with stupidity, and you're halfway to thinking like an idiot, muttered the woman, still not looking at Horza. He laughed again and got to his feet. Such bitterness, Balvena, he said. She looked up at him. I'll tell you, Horza, she said quietly. We're going to win. He shook his head. I don't think so. You wouldn't know how to. Balvena sat back again, hands spread behind her. Her face was serious. We can learn, Horza. Who from? Whoever has the lesson there to teach, she said slowly. We spend quite a lot of our time watching warriors and zealots, bullies and militarists, people determined to win regardless. There's no shortage of teachers. If you want to know about winning, ask the Adirans. Balvena said nothing for a moment. Her face was calm, thoughtful, perhaps sad. She nodded after a while. They do say there's a danger in warfare, she said, that you'll start to resemble the enemy. She shrugged. We just have to hope that we can avoid that. If the evolutionary force you seem to believe in really works, then it'll work through us and not the Idirans. If you're wrong, then it deserves to be superseded. Balvena, he said, laughing lightly. Don't disappoint me. I prefer a fight. You almost sound as though you're coming round to my point of view. No, she sighed. I'm not. Blame it on my special circumstances training. We try to think of everything. I was being pessimistic. I'd got the impression SC didn't allow such thoughts. Then think again, Mr. Changer, Balvena said, arching one eyebrow. SC allows all thoughts. That's what some people find so frightening about it. Horza thought he knew what the woman meant. Special circumstances had always been the contact section's moral espionage weapon, the very cutting edge of the culture's interfering diplomatic policy, the elite of the elite in a society which abhorred elitism. Even before the war, its standing and its image within the culture had been ambiguous. It was glamorous but dangerous, possessed of an aura of roguish sexiness, there was no other word for it, which implied predation, seduction, even violation. It had about it, too, an atmosphere of secrecy, in a society that virtually worshipped openness, which hinted at unpleasant, shaming deeds and an ambience of moral relativity, in a society which clung to its absolutes, life good, death bad, pleasure good, pain bad, which attracted and repulsed at once, but anyway excited. No other part of the culture more exactly represented what the society as a whole really stood for, or was more militant in the application of the culture's fundamental beliefs. Yet, no other part embodied less of the society's day-to-day character. With war, contact had become the culture's military, and special circumstances, its intelligence and espionage section. The euphemism became only a little more obvious, that was all. And with war, SC's position within the culture changed for the worse. It became the repository for the guilt the people in the culture experienced because they had agreed to go to war in the first place, despised as a necessary evil, reviled as an unpleasant moral compromise, dismissed as something people preferred not to think about. SC really did try to think of everything, though, and its minds were reputedly even more cynical, amoral and downright sneaky than those which made up contact. Machines without illusions, which prided themselves on thinking the thinkable to its ultimate extremities.
So it had been wearily predicted that just this would happen. SC would become a pariah, a whipping child, and its reputation a gland to absorb the poison in the culture's conscience. But Horza guessed that knowing all this didn't make it any easier for somebody like Balveda. Culture people had little stomach for being disliked by anybody, least of all their fellow citizens, and the woman's task was difficult enough without the added burden of knowing she was even greater anathema to most of her own side than she was to the enemy.
"Well, whatever, Balveda," he said, stretching.
He flexed his stiff shoulders within the suit, pulled his fingers through his thin yellow-white hair.
"I guess it'll work itself out."
Balveda laughed mirthlessly. Never a truer word. She shook her head.
"Thanks anyway," he told her.
"For what?"
"I think you just reinforced my faith in the ultimate outcome of this war."
"Oh, just go away, Horza." Balveda sighed and looked down to the floor.
Horza wanted to touch her, to ruffle her short black hair or pinch her pale cheek, but guessed it would only upset her more.
He knew too well the bitterness of defeat to want to aggravate the experience for somebody who was, in the end, a fair and honourable adversary. He went to the door, and after a word with the guard outside, he was let out.
"Ah, Borahosa,"
Zoralundra said, as the human appeared out of the cell doorway. The quirl came striding along the companionway. The guard outside the cell straightened visibly and blew some imaginary dust off his carbine.
"How is our guest?"
"Not very happy. We were trading justifications, and I think I won on points." Horza grinned. Zoralundra stopped by the man and looked down.
Well, unless you prefer to relish your victories in a vacuum, I suggest that the next time you leave my cabin while we are at battle stations, you take your..."
Horza didn't hear the next word. The ship's alarm erupted. The Adiran alarm signal, on a warship as elsewhere, consists of what sounds like a series of very sharp explosions. It is the amplified version of the Adiran chest boom, an evolved signal the Adirans had been using to warn others in their herd or clan for several hundred thousand years before they became civilized, and produced by the chest flap, which is the Adiran vestigial third arm. Horza clapped his hands to his ears, trying to shut out the awful noise. He could feel the shockwaves on his chest through the open neck of the suit. He felt himself being picked up and forced against the bulkhead. It was only then that he realized he had shut his eyes. For a second, he thought he had never been rescued, never left the wall of the sewer cell, that this was the moment of his death and all the rest had been a strange and vivid dream. He opened his eyes and found himself staring into the keratinous snout of the quirl Zoralundra, who shook him furiously, and, just as the ship alarm cut off and was replaced by a merely painfully intense whine, said very loudly into Horza's face,
"Helmet!"
"Oh, shit," said Horza. He was dropped to the deck as Zoralundra let him go, turned quickly and scooped a running medjail off the floor as it tried to get past him.
"You," Zoralundra bellowed, "I am the spy for the quirl of the fleet."
He shouted into its face and shook the six-limbed creature by the front of its suit.
"You will go to my cabin immediately and bring the small space helmet lying there to the portside stern emergency lock as fast as possible. This order supersedes all others and cannot be countermanded. Go."
He threw the medjail in the right direction. It landed running. Zoralundra flipped his own helmet over from its back-hinged position, then opened the visor. He looked as though he was about to say something to Horza, but the helmet speaker crackled and spoke, and the quirl's expression changed. The small noise stopped, and only the continuing wail of the cruiser's alarm was left.
"The culture craft was hiding in the surface layers of the system's sun," Zoralundra said bitterly, more to himself than to Horza. "In the sun?"
Horza was incredulous. He looked back at the cell door as though somehow it was Balveda's fault.
"Those bastards are getting smarter all the time."
"Yes," snapped the quirl, then turned quickly on one foot. "Follow me, human."
Horza obeyed, starting after the older Diran at a run, then bumping into him as the huge figure stopped in its tracks. Horza watched the broad, dark alien face as it swiveled round to look over his head at the Diran trooper still standing stiffly at the cell door. An expression Horza could not read passed over Zoralundra's face.
"Guard," the quirl said, not loudly.
The trooper with the laser carbine turned.
"Kill the woman."
Zoralundra stamped off down the corridor. Horza stood for a moment, looking first at the rapidly receding Quirrell, then at the guard as he checked his carbine, ordered the cell door to open and stepped inside. Then the man ran down the corridor after the older Dirren.
"Quirrell!"
gasped the Medjel as it skidded to a stop by the airlock, the suit helmet held in front of it. Zora Lundra swept the helmet from its grasp and fitted it quickly over Hawser's head.
"You will find a warp attachment in the lock," the Dirren told Hawser. "Get as far away as possible. The fleet will be here in about 9 standard hours. You shouldn't have to do anything. The suit will summon help on a coded IFF response. I, too..."
Zora Lundra broke off as the cruiser lurched. There was a loud bang, and Hawser was blown off his feet by a shockwave, while the Adiran on his tripod of legs hardly moved. The Medjel, which had gone for the helmet, yelped as it was blown under Zora Lundra's legs. The Adiran swore and kicked at it. It ran off. The cruiser lurched again as other alarms started. Hawser could smell burning. A confused medley of noises that might have been Adiran voices or muffled explosions came from somewhere overhead.
"I too shall try to escape," Zora Lundra continued. "God be with you, human."
Before Hawser could say anything, the Adiran had rammed his visor down and pushed him into the lock. It slammed shut. Hawser was thrown against one bulkhead as the cruiser juddered mightily. He looked desperately round the small spherical space for a warp unit, then saw it, and after a short struggle, unclamped it from its wall magnets. He clamped it to the rear of his suit.
"Ready?" a voice said in his ear.
Hawser jumped, then said, "Yes, yes, hit it." The airlock didn't open conventionally. It turned inside out and threw him into space, tumbling away from the flat disk of the cruiser in a tiny galaxy of ice particles. He looked for the culture ship, then told himself not to be stupid. It was probably still several trillion kilometers away. That was how divorced from the human scale modern warfare had become. You could smash and destroy from unthinkable distances, obliterate planets from beyond their own system, and provoke stars into novae from light years off, and still have no good idea why you are really fighting. With one last thought for Balveda, Hawser reached until he found the control handle of the bulky warp unit, fingered the correct buttons on it, and watched the stars twist and distort around him as the unit sent him and his suit lancing away from the stricken Adiran spacecraft. He played with the wrist set for a while, trying to pick up signals from the hand of God 137, but got nothing but static. The suit spoke to him once, saying, "Warp unit. Charge. Half exhausted." Hawser kept a watch on the warp unit via a small screen set inside the helmet. He recalled that the Adirans said some sort of prayer to their god before going into warp. Once, when he had been with Zora Lundra on a ship which was warping, the Quirrell had insisted that the changer repeat the prayer too. Hawser had protested that it meant nothing to him. Not only did the Adiran god clash with his own personal convictions, the prayer itself was in a dead Adiran language he didn't understand. He'd been told, rather coldly, that it was the gesture that mattered. For what the Adirans regarded as essentially an animal, their word for humanoids was best translated as biautomaton, only the behaviour of devotion was required. His heart and mind were of no consequence. When Hawser had asked what about his immortal soul, Zora Lundra had laughed. It was the first and only time Hawser had experienced such a thing from the old warrior. Whoever heard of a mortal body having an immortal soul? When the warp unit was almost exhausted, Hawser shut it off. Stars swam into focus around him. He set the unit controls, then threw it away from him. They parted company, he moving slowly off in one direction, while the unit spun off in another. Then it disappeared, as the controls switched it back on again to use the last of its power, leading anybody following its trace away in the wrong direction. He calmed his breathing down gradually. It had been very fast and hard for a while, but he slowed it and his heart deliberately. He accustomed himself to the suit, testing its functions and powers. It smelled and felt new, and looked like a Rech-built device. Rech suits were meant to be among the best. People said that the culture made better ones, but people said the culture made better everything, and they were still losing the war. Hawser checked out the lasers the suit had built in, and searched for the concealed pistol he knew it ought to carry. He found it at last, disguised as part of the left forearm casing, a small plasma handgun. He felt like shooting it at something, but there was nothing to aim at. He put it back. He folded his arms across his bulky chest and looked around. Stars were everywhere. He had no idea which one was Sorpin's. So, The culture ships could hide in the photospheres of stars, could they? And a mind, even if it was desperate and on the run, could jump through the bottom of a gravity well, could it? Maybe the Adirans would have a tougher job than they expected. They were the natural warriors. They had the experience and the guts, and their whole society was geared for continual conflict. But the culture, that seemingly disunited, anarchic, hedonistic, decadent melange of more or less human species, forever hiving off or absorbing different groups of people, had fought for almost 4 years without showing any sign of giving up or even coming to a compromise. What everybody had expected to be at best a brief, limited stand, lasting just long enough to make a point, had developed into a wholehearted war effort. The early reverses and first few megadeaths had not, as the pundits and experts had predicted, shocked the culture into retiring, horrified at the brutalities of war, but proud to have put its collective life where usually only its collective mouth was. Instead, it had just kept on retreating and retreating, preparing, gearing up and planning. Horza was convinced the minds were behind it all. He could not believe the ordinary people in the culture really wanted the war, no matter how they had voted. They had their communist utopia. They were soft and pampered and indulged, and the contact section's evangelical materialism provided their conscience-salving good works. What more could they want? The war had to be the mind's idea. It was part of their clinical drive to clean up the galaxy, make it run on nice, efficient lines, without waste, injustice or suffering. The fools in the culture couldn't see that one day the minds would start thinking how wasteful and inefficient the humans in the culture themselves were. Horza used the suit's internal gyros to steer himself, letting him look at every part of the sky, wondering where in that light-flecked emptiness battles raged and billions died, where the culture still held and the Adiran battle fleets pressed. The suit hummed and clicked and hissed very quietly around him, precise, obedient, reassuring. Suddenly it jolted, steadying him without warning and jarring his teeth. A noise, uncomfortably like a collision alarm, trilled violently in one ear, and out of the corner of his eye, Horza could see a microscreen set inside the helmet near his left cheek light up with a hollow red graph display. "Target, acquisition, radar," the suit said. "Incoming, increasing."